Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, you know, on American Variety, as the title implies, it is kind of an eclectic show. And in the past, over the last few years, we've had a couple shows. There was a guy on once who had years before, during his misspent youth, had spent several months in, I think it was like the Nigerian rainforest or some swamp, some impenetrable jungle in the middle of an African country, chasing a mythical creature called Mbele Nkele or something like that, as I recalled, and, you know, with native guides and his whole expedition he did, and came out alive, which I guess was the lucky part, never found the mythical creature. But we've had a couple shows on UFOs and that kind of thing, so, you know, I'm interested in pretty much everything. You know, our watchword is anything but politics on American Variety. So today is a similar show. My guest is Scott Poole. W. Scott Poole is a professor of American history at the College of Charleston in South Carolina, and he professes to have a lifelong fascination with monsters in all their weird shapes and grisly forms. And Scott has written a fascinating book about the subject called Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Cord. I'm pretty excited to be on. Thanks for letting me come and talk about my monsters with you.
Well, I'm glad you're on with us. I think this is going to end up being one of those shows that I wish were longer, as often happens. But this time of year, around Halloween, you must be in your element, right? So.
Yeah, absolutely. Halloween's sort of a busy time for me. Fun time, too, obviously.
Do you find you have trouble sleeping? You toss and turn at night, especially when the moon is full, and you feel a strange bloodlust rising?
Yeah, just can't get enough thinking about monsters, just kind of all the time. Yeah, absolutely.
But you don't have an excess of facial hair suddenly appearing or anything like that?
I haven't been told about that. You'd have to ask my wife, I think, probably, that question.
Oh, you shave every morning anyway. All right, so the general premise of your book is that in our culture, we concoct monsters to fit our fears at any given time. And I guess that's a fair statement in 25 words or less, right?
Basically, yeah.
So why don't you give us some examples going back through American history, especially some of those that we may not be aware of monsters that have been prevalent in our culture at different times in America.
Sure, absolutely. One thing I would say to Court, just to tweak your definition just a little bit of what I'm trying to do, is that I sort of say that, you know, in a way they're not so much reflections of our fears, in that rather they fit our fears. Mm-hmm. In a sense, they are what we are afraid of, which is a little different from, you know, sort of the notion that you actually find in a lot of books, especially scholarly books about monsters, that they are reflections of our anxieties in different kinds of ways. I actually think monsters are a little bit more than that, and I can explain that through a couple of examples.
Okay.
One that sort of comes to mind right away is the role that the monster played in the history of the Atlantic slave trade and how that intersected with American history, particularly in the 17th century and in the 18th century. We, of course, had this horrific period where, you know, you literally have tens of thousands of human beings coming to North America, millions coming to the New World. And not surprisingly, because of the terrors and the horrors and the barbarities of that period, you have this whole sort of world of monster stories that develop. And monster stories from lots of different directions. You have enslaved Africans themselves who seem to have believed that the slave catchers and the slave masters and the slave merchants were these sort of monstrous cannibals. I came across one story, just for example, in Louisiana, where some newly arrived Africans, when they saw their new masters drinking red wine, they were basically convinced that they were dealing with vampires, that they were watching these sort of monstrous creatures that had kidnapped them, literally drinking blood. And then from the other side of it, Europeans at first, and then North Americans who took part in the slave trade, had sort of this whole mythology of monstrous races, which they applied to African people. I actually believe in a sense that the story of the monster is the story of the birth of American racism in some of its more vicious aspects. And so what you have going on there is you have the real terrors of history, and I say in the book, history is horror. And at the same time, you've got these tales of monsters, these monstrous narratives, and they're interconnected. And the one way I've kind of pictured this in my own mind is that they're kind of interconnected, you know, sort of like strands of DNA, almost as if the monster is sort of the deep genetic code of our culture. And it's almost hard to pull them apart. These sort of terrible, violent, hard to look at things in our history and monster tales that have grown up and sort of mushroomed around them.
You know, so I think if, I mean, that was one kind of cluster of monsters revolving around racism and the slave trade back early in our country's history. But if you think forward into more recent times, you know, whether it's King Kong or Bigfoot or, you know, a lot of the other kind of fantastical monsters that we can think of, you know, Godzilla or Mothra or things in the movies, you know, most of them are clearly recognizable as fantasies, you know, not as things that people think are real. Now, the ones you just described, I think some percentage of the population maybe thought was real, right? But as time went on, maybe into a more sophisticated age where there was at least some modicum of education that most people had, people see them as being not real things. But what function does that serve when it's clear that the monster is not really something you're going to encounter around the other side of the shopping center, but is a fantasy, but yet it exists as a monster concept? What, you know, what does that do for us?
No, yeah, that's a great question, and it's a question that I was sort of asking myself the whole time I was writing the book, because, you know, I'm kind of balancing, on the one hand, you know, folk legends, things that people really believed, with pop culture, and obviously, particularly in the 20th century, and really even earlier, I spend a lot of time with pop culture. And the way that I have thought about that is that, you know, there's a favorite writer of mine, Slavoj Zizek, who says that in talking about pop culture, that fantasy scenarios, fantasy constructions of all kinds, like you're talking about, often obscure the true horror of the situation. That is, that they are forums for us to talk about things that are difficult to talk about in other ways, and that do have, a really intimate relationship with those real horrors of our history. You know, you mentioned Godzilla, for example, which is one of my favorite monsters. You know, there's something about gigantic lizards rising out of the sea that really does it for me. I like Godzilla a lot. And one of the interesting things about studying kind of the transformation of the Godzilla story in the 1950s is that in Japan, and in fact in the Japanese version that you can watch today, Gojira, Godzilla, there is this heavy, heavy emphasis on the role of the atomic bomb. There's an emphasis on Hiroshima. There's actually some very direct references, even in some of the imagery, to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then in the American version of that, those references are literally deleted. They're literally removed in various kinds of ways from the film. And so, you know, that would be an example for me from American history, where the fantasy monster, although it's certainly tied to this sort of sub-theme, these fears of radioactivity, Cold War fears of the atomic war, they can also sometimes become a way to sort of obscure what's real. So in that way, I think they almost function a little bit like nightmares. I mean, nightmares are real. Social nightmares are real. They are often using symbolic material of different kinds to talk about things that are actually happening to us. So I'm sort of careful, I guess, with the these are creatures of fantasy. These are symbols and these are metaphors, because I think it's really important that we, you know, that we take our monsters seriously. In a way, that's part of the message of my book, I think, to historians in particular, that monsters offer a way into some hidden parts, some submerged elements of the American psyche that there's maybe no other way to get to.
Well, you know, there are a few types of monsters that, to me at least, remain ambiguous. UFOs and maybe ghosts come to mind. I mean, large numbers of reasonable people claim to have seen them over decades, right? So do some monsters, or what I guess in your book you call monsters, have a core of reality to them in your view?
Well, yes, in the sense, and I'm always careful in talking about this, mostly careful. You know, I actually start off the book saying Be aware. I believe in monsters,
mm-hmm.
and that was taking a real risk because I mean, some people may shut the book immediately and sort of think, well, you know, he's a Fordian, a paranormal
buff.
Nut.
Yeah.
He thinks he's kind of a low rent Fox Mulder or something. And that's not what I mean at all. I mean, what I mean is that they are such powerful constructions that our popular culture monsters are so hardwired into our historical experiences that I'm just really careful to talk about them as fantasies. And in fact, mentioned the Cold War era a second ago. Another example of this that I would give is that, you know, of course, other than Westerns, the sci-fi genre, particularly the alien invasion genre, was really kind of the most popular form of film after World War II, really all the way up through the 1950s. And it wasn't simply a pop culture phenomenon. You do have people who begin seeing flying saucers, and actually the first period of kind of alleged encounters, alleged contactees occurs during this era. And, of course, the American government gets involved in it as well. I mean, there's a real American Air Force project called Project Blue Book that supposedly was investigating the phenomenon of flying saucers while, you know, people were going to the movie theater to watch Invasion of the Body Snatchers and, you know, Mars Attacks Earth and all of those kinds of things. So there's a really, again, kind of back to my DNA image, it's sort of like the strands are so closely tied together sometimes that they're hard to pull apart.
Well, the other thing is there's not just one kind of monolithic monster. They range from A to Z in terms of types. I mean, you know,
right.
in your book you describe all kinds of things, even serial killers and
yep.
and you know, little people and people that used to be in circus sideshows and
right.
just a huge range from, you know, the science fiction part to, you know, so they're generated by, I guess, general features of our culture, and so you can kind of break them down, and you do in your book. I mean, some are generated by gender and sexuality, and
right.
others by race, you talked about earlier, and some by science and technology, we talked about earlier, but others by religion and
mm-hmm.
by economic conditions in general, and so it's really, I guess, hard to make any kind of blanket statements about the origins and the meaning of monsters, because there's so many different types, you know?
There are, and there's actually not, you know, a point in the book where I actually refuse to give at the beginning very, very clearly. I say I'm not going to give an abstract
mm-hmm.
definition of the monster. The monster has meant and has been many different things. And as you point out, it's a book that looks at everything from sea serpents to serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
I do see some commonalities. But in part because I'm a historian, I really believe that what scares us and what repulses us, as well as what fascinates us and draws us, changes depending on the historical period.
Yeah.
And so it's, in that sense, it's very much a, despite the subject matter, it's very much a kind of a traditional historical study. What was going on in the late 19th, early 20th century that made Frankenstein such an important monster to people? Why did people care about aliens after World War II, whereas now it's vampires and zombies? So I'm really interested in, as any historian would be, in the historical variables that are at work.
Are those two sides of the same coin, the things that horrify us and repel us and the things that fascinate us and attract us? Are they kind of connected psychologically?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I believe they're connected psychologically. But I also believe that, you know, there's sort of historical empirical proof that is the case. And I think that in the United States, part of what the monster has tended to mean, this is maybe true kind of across eras, is because they've been a way to talk about our fears and anxieties, they've often been a way, even when we're interested in them, to express kind of these dark parts of the American experience that often Americans have a hard time, I think, talking about. You know, Americans really do like to have as kind of our official ideology this very sort of sunny, very optimistic, this sort of frontier spirit kind of stuff. And so there's a lot submerged there that monsters become a way to talk about and encounter those things without encountering them, truly, in some sense. And actually, my Godzilla example would, I think, provide a good way to see that.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking here with W. Scott Poole, who's the author of a book, Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting. So Scott, what is, you know, if there's a simple answer, and I don't know if there is, what has generated the most monstrosity overall across the centuries in America? Is it maybe sex or religion or fear of the wild frontier or what, do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there is no simple answer to that. I would say that one theme that I saw again and again was the theme of violence, sort of the American tradition of violence, which is part of the frontier experience, also part of the experience of racial slavery, combined with actually sort of the idea of outraged innocence, the notion that horror, terror emerges out of what is good and what is pure becoming damaged and corrupted. And I actually believe, for example, just to provide one historic example of this, this was part of the appeal, the explosive appeal that I think we don't always recognize of Bela Lugosi's Dracula back in 1931. This came at a period, an end of a historical period, where there was a lot of nervousness about immigration, not unlike today, in fact. There was also, and I go into some detail on this, so I'll just give you the brief version, there was what was called the white slavery panic. There was this sort of urban legend that immigrant men, particularly in cities, were seducing innocent farm girls, leading them down, you know, to the path of ruination.
Hmm.
And like most urban legends, there wasn't much to that, but it certainly became a powerful part of the cultural discourse. And then you get Dracula, who is an immigrant, essentially. In fact, he's an Eastern European immigrant. The sort of same group that many Americans are so worried about, you know, sort of corrupting American innocence. And what does he do? Well, he's very seductive, and he's particularly seductive to sort of these perfect ideals of, you know, white Anglo-Saxon womanhood. And an even more sort of powerful part of that was that Bela Lugosi himself, many people don't realize this now, but he was actually quite the sex symbol in the 1930s.
Hmm.
He was married to Clara Bow, the original It Girl, as she was called, and so was quite the heartthrob. My wife Beth actually still thinks that the young Bela Lugosi is quite an attractive quite an attractive figure.
Well, his hair is kind of greased back by our standards, but still,
right.
But he's a sharp dresser.
A sharp dresser, absolutely.
Well, you know, so we're talking really about the influence of the media, and it struck me in looking at your book that originally, these stories were conveyed by books to those who could read and had the time to read, but I would think that films in the early 20th century suddenly gave monsterness a huge boost over books, right?
So right.
To a much broader audience where it was much easier to see and get hold of. But would you say that TV added to that again?
I think so. I think certainly over the last 20 years or so, horror has particularly become important on TV. As we all know, it's become especially important in the last few years with, you know, just mega hits. Monster hits, you might say, like True Blood and The Walking Dead and other kinds of things.
Twilight.
Yeah, the media in which monsters have been portrayed has changed over time. I also, though, you know, I think it's really important to think about the fact that even before the 20th century, before film, there were sort of subliterate monster tales, the tales told in the tavern, the tales told around the campfire, and that hasn't entirely disappeared either. I actually think that urban legend, sort of, you know, sub-media type outlets continue to provide a way that monster stories circulate,
mm-hmm.
and people find strange ways to talk about the American experience.
Well, I was going to ask you if the internet in the last 15 years or so has had another big impact, kind of
Absolutely.
Like TV did, and so how does
work? I mean, the urban legend in its modern form, urban legends in their modern form, have really. Really a product of the post-World War II, really the 1960s era, in which, you know, media allowed the spread of these stories that previously had just been kind of word of mouth to just, you know, explode exponentially. So add the internet into that, and obviously what you've got, as we well know, I mean, Facebook is just absolutely rife with the spread of urban legends of different kinds. I mean, you know, email has become a way to send chain letters. All of these different sort of outlets have become new ways to spread monster stories, new ways often to ignite moral panics over the fear of monsters, particularly serial killers, conceptions of crime, particularly in marginal communities. So absolutely, the sort of the digital frontier is where the new monsters live, just like they lived on the original frontier in early American history.
Interesting. You call serial killers monsters, but to me they're not invented or even exaggerated. I mean, they're completely real, and their horrors are their horrors. Are they in a different category somehow?
I would actually argue no, and the reason is that... part of what interests me about the serial killer is that you have this monster, again, a real-life monster, although, again, I think all my monsters are real-life in a sense, that was perceived in the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s as this major threat, an almost kind of unstoppable threat to the American public, when actually... during that period, statistics show that a very, very small percentage of homicides could be classified as the work of serial killers. So small as to be sort of statistically insignificant.
Okay.
And yet, you had a mountain, as you know, of films, books, and pronouncements from official sources on the role of the serial killer in American society that suggested that this was a major monster out there that could threaten essentially anyone. And I take issue with that. I actually call into question, in fact, some of the FBI's tactics during that era that I think may have helped to really kind of ignite, as I've mentioned earlier, a moral panic over that issue. It's very similar, actually, to the missing child moral panic of the same period. Statistically, incidents of missing children were going down in the 1980s, and yet you had a massive amount of media coverage and representations in popular culture that suggested that it was a kind of an epidemic. So in a sense, I think that the serial killer is a sort of a social construction, a social nightmare, in the same way my other monsters are. Although I certainly look at the fascination with, you know, these real life serial killers, John Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy, and others, and sort of what that says about us during that particular period.
Yeah. Okay. I see what you're saying. It's kind of the media elevate the work of a serial killer to the level of domestic terrorism, and because they amplify it and follow the story, and it's not just a one-time, one-shot, literally, killing. It's, you know, it's a story that goes on, and the fear can get ramped up by the focus of it in the media. So,
absolutely, and you know, of course, they become sort of our favorite monster, and I would stress that it's not just that Americans were terrified of the serial killer in that period. They were and are fascinated with the serial killer. And so in that way, you know, there's a real similarity to these other kinds of monsters that I've been talking about. It's interesting also to look at sort of the apotheosis of the serial killer in the popularity of Dexter today, where you have the serial killer as hero in many respects. kind of a fascinating trajectory from where we were in the 1980s.
Are Americans more fascinated with monsters than people in other countries are?
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot, actually. And I would say, you know, I think the simple answer is no. I think that, you know, obviously the world over, societies have various kinds of monsterologies. You know, what in Japan is called the Kejin tradition, the sort of the world of the weird is sort of one way to put that, and that they often are tied into cultural histories. I think what makes American monsters a little bit different is this prevailing notion with us since really the founding, with us since the Revolutionary War era, of a kind of an original American innocence. The idea that we're sort of America the innocent in different kinds of ways, America the good. And so I think that that is why maybe at certain periods the monster has exercised a special kind of attraction for us, a way to explore our dark side that as a culture we know is there, but don't always want to look at because of, again, our sort of official representation of ourselves, who we see ourselves to be as a culture, who we believe we've been historically.
Are there any monsters you think might actually exist or have existed?
You know, I'm a skeptic in the area of, you know, empirical data about monsters, about religion in a lot of different areas. I think that I do believe that monsters exist in the sense that I have talked about them, and in a way that is almost enough. You know, the idea that monsters are hardwired into our historical experience, that almost gives me more than enough to think about rather than worrying about the existence of the unproven and the unprovable. So I would classify myself as a skeptic, but an open-minded one.
Scott, we just have a minute or so left, but what monsters do you think might be coming next in our culture? Can you give us a monster forecast?
Absolutely. I do a little bit of this in the book. I really think that, you know, the post-human monster, by which I mean everything from killer androids, killer computers, even our experience on the internet may be our next monster. I've been thinking a lot lately about that idea of the digital frontier and the way in which, you know, we're sort of becoming internet constructs in different ways on Facebook and Twitter, maybe sort of trapped in those roles. There's some real elements of terror there that I think that in the next 10 years or so we're going to be exploring more and more.
I guess the computer HAL in 2001 A Space Odyssey might have been the first big example of that then.
I think so, yeah, the first killer computer. I think more and more, though, we're going to find stories about being locked into the killer computer, our consciousness sort of lost into those scary mechanized worlds.
Well, Scott, we've got to leave it there. We've been talking with W. Scott Poole, P-O-O-L-E, who's the author of Monsters in America. It's published by the Baylor University Press. You can go to monstersinamerica.com and buy the book, and it's also available through Amazon and other booksellers. Scott, thanks so much for being on with us. It's been fascinating.
Thanks, Corder. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks to you all for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.